Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you click on it, download it, put it on your iPod, possibly iPad, you know, whatever device you want to store it on and listen to it. Today we have, what's easy to say is an excellent show on the admissibility of ESI with two judges who are really well-known in the e-discovery world, and they've both offered articles and opinions on admissibility issues associated with ESI. Our guests are Judge James Rosenbaum from the United States District Court of Minnesota and Magistrate Judge Paul Grimm from the United States District Court of Maryland. Judge James M. Rosenbaum is a federal judge for the United States District Court of the District of Minnesota. He began practice in Chicago, Illinois as a VISTA lawyer, trying federal civil rights cases, and in 1972 returned to Minnesota to begin private practice specializing in trial work. In 1981, Judge Rosenbaum was appointed Minnesota's United States Attorney. He served that until 1985 when he was appointed to the United States District Court. He served from 1997 to 2005 as the Eighth Circuit's elected representative to the Judicial Conference of the United States, the judiciary's governing authority. He's a frequent speaker and teacher. His articles, In Defense of the Delete Key, another article, In Defense of Rule 808, Federal Rules of Evidence, and Defense of the Sugar Bowl is another article, In Defense of the Hard Drive. I mean, there are lots of great articles. They've been translated into nearly 20 languages. And he lectures both at home and abroad on legal technology and intellectual property issues. Judge Rosenbaum, thanks for joining the show.
My pleasure.
And Judge Grimm, of course, is now the leader of the ESI Bytes panelists, moving ahead of, I think you broke a tie with Craig Ball or something like that, but serves as the full-time magistrate judge for the United States District Court for the District of Maryland. He was appointed in February 1997. He's adjunct faculty member of the University of Maryland School of Law, where he teaches trial evidence, pretrial civil procedure, and scientific evidence. Judge Grimm is a frequent lecturer at CLE programs on issues regarding evidence and civil procedure and has published several books and numerous articles on these topics. A list of cases which he has been authored are almost like the set of federal rules on e-discovery. I mean, Mancia versus Mayflower Textile Services on the Cooperation Proclamation, Victor Stanley, Inc. v. Creative Pipe, and the need to explain why search terms are being created when privileged materials were disclosed to the other side, Hobson v. Mayor of Baltimore, on the complications of privilege waiver with the disclosure of privilege or work product ESI between different state jurisdictions, and, of course, case that's relevant today, Lorraine v. Markle, American Insurance Company, on admissibility and authentication of ESI. So let's jump right in. First of all, thanks for both of you joining us on this. This is going to be, I hope, an excellent discussion.
Pleasure.
And Judge Grimm, let's jump right in and let's talk about Lorraine v. Markle. It's 2007 when you authored this decision, and the federal rules addressing electronic discovery have just been published the previous December of 2006. And understanding there was a case here which raised these issues, but you did write a very comprehensive opinion on the admissibility of ESI in a case where the damages at stake, I believe, were well under $100,000. Was there a message greater than the underlying litigation which you were seeking to deliver through the opinion?
I will say this. The simple answer is yes. I think the amount in litigation was under $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
I had been interested in this area for a long time. Obviously, the issues associated with discovery of ESI has been around with increasing focus by the court since around 2000, 2001. And I became concerned that the focus on discovery, given the small percentage of cases that go to trial in either criminal or civil matters in federal court, that with all the emphasis on discoverability, insufficient attention was being paid to admissibility issues, and had been waiting for something comprehensive to sort of talk about this new media, the digital media, and the evidentiary foundations necessary to get it admitted. And after waiting a couple of years for an opportunity, not seeing any come by, when the first opportunity presented itself, I wrote a rather long opinion, which many would argue is a cure for insomnia. And in the process, my law clerk, who did a magnificent job of site checking, because the drafting was done by me, came to me and said, "Wouldn't we be better off publishing this as a law review article?" And I said, "Well, the problem is that if you publish it as a law review article, few people will read it. If you publish it as an opinion, at least it will get read, even if people don't agree with it." And we did that, and that was 2007. Ironically, 2 years later, the University of Akron Law Review contacted me and asked me to do a law review article about it, which was published in 2009. And so it's sort of like that Seinfeld episode where Kramer had a coffee table book about coffee tables. It was the opinion that was a law review that became a law review.
Well, now you're 2 years later. How do you believe the message has been received in practice?
I get Westlaw hits whenever Lorraine is cited in either an opinion or in a brief, and I must get two or three hits a week, oftentimes several hits a day. So it's obviously been cited. I think that what has happened is that at least in summary judgment practice in civil cases, and what seems to be the case rather frequently in criminal cases, lawyers are becoming aware of the fact that with digital media and new devices, as you mentioned, you know, the iPad went on sale this last weekend, they are becoming aware of the fact that they have to focus on the admissibility issues, and that means that with digital platforms where reliability of information is assumed in some instances when it should not be, that they have to pay careful attention to it. And while I still have not seen objections in the trials that I presided over, nor even a significant amount of motions practiced in limine, or even challenges to evidence in summary judgment practice, if you look at the number of articles and the fact that cases are coming out all the time that deal with admissibility issues, I will tell you that they tend to be very discreet and that the issues tend to be very narrow and pinpoint and dealt with rather quickly. And I think that Judge Rosenbaum has, in his Rule 808 green bag article, pointed out that the trend has been to let them in without a great deal of underlying review, but I believe that gradually the awareness is going out of the need to focus on these admissibility issues, but we're far from having it be universal, I think.
Judge Rosenbaum, if you want to weigh in, where do you see the biggest tensions or risks on the admission of ESI that hasn't really been, you know, put through the vetting process?
Well, interestingly, I think the focus has been on access and gathering. There has not been a great deal of attention paid to admissibility. Partly, I believe it's a function of what I refer to as a brotherhood of terror. If I challenge the admissibility of your electronic material, you'll challenge mine. And I think there's sort of a sense that if the geeks are happy, I can live with it on both sides. It's the whole nature. I mean, anything you get that's electronic, and everything that you get is electronic, is simply a collection of either pluses and minuses or ones and zeros. And the net result is there are formulas behind all of these things, and they're extraordinarily complex, and everybody sort of accepts a great deal of it. That having been said, I think there's pretty sound reasons why you actually ought to think about that a little more clearly. For one thing, as the magistrate judge Frank Noel, with whom I frequently work, put it, you know what we call e-discovery? And I said no, and he said we call it discovery. There's really no difference. There's almost nothing that's not electronic any longer. The reality of it is you still have to satisfy, in order to satisfy classic admissibility, the rules of evidence. Does it come in as evidence? My personal favorite is metadata. You can spend endless amounts on it, but I'm not sure that any of it is admissible. Nobody knows who the declarant is. Nobody knows. Nobody can authenticate it, and nobody exactly knows what it proves. but you sure hear a lot of references to it, and there will be discussions about it in court, and nobody will say a word. And most of the time, if nobody objects, it's fine with me, but I think it's something that people ought to look at once in a while.
Judge Grimm, what does a judge consider when deciding if a satisfactory foundation for authenticity has been offered?
Well, the authenticity rules are found in Rule 901 and 902 of the Rules of Evidence. Rule 901 articulates a basic rule as to what authentication or identification is. And it reminds me of when I was growing up, the cartoons we used to watch. One of the cartoons was Popeye, the Sailor Man. And Popeye had a saying, and he would say, "I am what I am. I am what I am." And that's all Rule 901A says, is that before you offer evidence that is, generally speaking, documentary, tangible evidence, such as a document, a record, it could be real evidence, such as a gun or a photograph or any of those other types of things, other than a witness actually testifying, that you must establish by a preponderance of evidence that it is what the proponent says it is, identification or authentication. That's all the requirement is. There is no one way of authenticating, and Rule 901B identifies 10 non-exclusive methods of authenticating evidence that can include a number that are particularly well-suited to ESI. Rule 901B one is a witness with personal knowledge. So if I wrote an email or if I got an email from someone, then I have personal knowledge of having either written it or received it, and I can testify that, yeah, I looked at this. This is what I remember receiving or sending, and that's authentic. That may be enough to authenticate it. Rule 901B3 allows authentication by using an expert to testify or by showing a known example to have been made by a source with a questioned one, and the jury can supply the analysis itself. Rule 901B4 is particularly important, and I think this is what Judge Rosenbaum referred to with his wonderfully tongue-in-cheek but also very insightful Greenbag article, Hearsay Rule 808, which is circumstantial evidence, and that is that distinctive circumstances or characteristics allow it to be authenticated. So the logo on an email or the doctrine of reply that it was sent and replied to or distinctive characteristics are examples of that. Rule 901B9 is the most important because it allows authentication by evidence that the item to be authenticated or identified was created by a system or a process capable of producing reliable results. This would require sponsoring testimony, often from an expert, and all you have to do is show that, for example, if you have a digital record that has been prepared, that you can demonstrate that the information prepared was done in a way that was both reliable when it was entered and also that it was maintained in a way that would prevent it from being altered or modified later. Rule 902 deals with matters of self-authentication, and in that regard, many types of ESI could be authenticated either as public records or documents or official publications or trade inscriptions or including business records as well that can be done with under Rule 902 11 and 12, business records can be authenticated with a certificate and an affidavit. So there's no shortage of methods, of rule-based methods to authenticate. What Judge Rosenbaum said that I agree with completely is folks seem not to even look at them to try to say, this is the method or methods that I want to employ. They just have this sort of mutually assured destruction notion that that they either stipulate or they don't object. But when push comes to shove, some care ought to be taken to authenticate, and there are ample number of rules that can give you help in how to do that.
If I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Judge.
Important. I absolutely agree with Magistrate Judge Grimm. But from a judge's standpoint, authenticity is a first question. but it is not at all equivalent to admissibility.
Correct.
And as a convenient example, I can write out a statement that says Carl Schunemann, was the kidnapped the Lindbergh baby. I could make out an affidavit to it, bring in a whole chorus of people who would swear that I actually wrote it, so there's no question about it, but that doesn't mean it's admissible. That simply means it's authentic, and authenticity ought not to be equated with admissibility, and that's another one of the little chords that I tried to strike. First of all, I have to tell you, Paul, I'm so thrilled. You know, you may be one of the other 8 people who've ever read the thing that I wrote.
I love it.
But I did enjoy writing it, just because in court, you know, you see the lawyer stand up and say, I offer you an email, and everybody sort of falls back, and that's the end of the inquiry. Well, it is an email. The question is it admissible? And they don't seem to look at that second question.
Well, and if I may, Carl, again,
Yeah. Forgive
me, because I think that Judge Rosenbaum's point is if there's a single takeaway point from this whole podcast, he has just highlighted it, and it's very, very important. In the Lorraine opinion, what I advise is this, and it's exactly what Judge Rosenbaum just said. There are 5 separate evidentiary issues that potentially will govern whether or not ESI is admissible. And each one of those could be imagined as if it was a steeplechase. Imagine a steeplechase race by a horse or by a runner. And they start running, and there's a first hurdle. They have to leap over the hurdle, and then they run, and then there's another one they have to leap over. And you don't win the race unless you've gone all the way around, leaped over all the hurdles and gotten it in. All of them may not apply, but all of them must be considered. And if you consider them in sequence, then you will not miss something, and you know what you have to address for admissibility. So the first one is relevance. Is it relevant under Rule 401? An easy threshold. Secondly, is it authentic? Is it what it purports to be? Third, if it is offered for its substantive truth, and this is what Judge Rosenbaum was just saying, does it constitute hearsay? And if so, is it admissible under a hearsay exception? And much can be said about those exceptions. Next, you have to deal with the issue associated with the original writing rule, a rule of evidence that was considered to be dead when the photocopier was invented, but with digital evidence that can be manipulated and altered, it has new resurrection of life, because what you end up with is, what is the original in a digital record? Is it what you see on your screen, or is it all the metadata behind it? And I think that Judge Rosenbaum is correct that metadata is oftentimes useless, but in the instances when it's important, it becomes critical. And the final issue is when you've evaluated under the original writing rules, 1004 through 1008, the final thing that you have to look at is prejudice under Rule 403. Is it excessively prejudicial when considered as balanced against its probative value? And unless you have gone through all 5 of those evaluative criteria and either demonstrated, well, we don't have to worry about hearsay because I'm not offering it for its substantive truth, or we don't talk about the original writing rule because we have the author who can say it's the original, then you do not guarantee admissibility. So authentication is a necessary condition precedent, but it's the first of potentially 5 questions that have to be answered. And if you focus only on that, just as if you ask someone to stipulate to authenticity and don't ask them to stipulate to admissibility, you can be tripped up if there's an objection.
And let me even follow up with Judge Grimm. Other than a very both accurate but short reference to metadata, you could take everything he just said and it would fit 35 years ago or longer in any evidence course. The fact that the rules for what is admissible have not changed because it's electronic. This relates to whether or not it is a letter that's admitted, a physical object that was found somewhere, a recollection that somebody had a conversation with somebody else. All of these things are the same factors. The fact that it's electronic, nothing magic happened.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw one point in on the metadata. Offering evidence to prove something in court is one use of metadata. Sorting data and trying to identify the data that you want to produce or using metadata to reduce the effort is a different use of metadata, and I don't think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about proving something in court.
Now we're talking about there's all kinds of you can trace what's been done, you can make records, but it's important to recognize that metadata is manipulable. You can change it in ways that you cannot change the substantive evidence, but that doesn't make it admissible. Lots of people that I know well set their own metadata and use it as a sort of internal cataloging system. There's all kinds of things you can do with it. That doesn't mean it's good or bad, but it certainly doesn't mean it's admissible.
Yep. Well, I'm glad I called the podcast the admissibility of ESI instead of the authentication of ESI. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the Brotherhood of Terror. You mentioned Judge Rosenbaum on, you know, the lack of scrutiny on whether ESI actually should be admissible. But as a follow-up question, there does appear to be a difference between civil litigation and criminal litigation and the fights over the admissibility of ESI. And would you care to talk about some of those differences and if there are any lessons which civil litigators maybe can or should learn from criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors?
Actually, it almost runs the other way most of the time. This is one of the very few areas where the civil lawyers, at least in their ability to deal with the electronics, have been ahead of the criminal lawyers. Mostly because I think the civil lawyers who appear in our court come from large firms which have, remarkably enough, more money than the prosecutors and defense lawyers do. So at least in terms of hardware, they're usually ahead. In terms of evidence presentation and trial practice, the criminal lawyers tend to be more practiced because they try more cases on a general basis than civil lawyers do. The most electronic evidence in some ways is so common in criminal cases, people don't even think about it anymore. Wiretaps of telephone calls have been admitted and regularly used for probably 35 years. A great deal of the investigative stuff, every search warrant almost always right now is accompanied by a videographer who takes the material. Almost every squad car is equipped with with mics to pick up the sounds of people who are seated in the back seat. And many, many squad cars now have got television cameras built into the visors so that they film virtually or film or video, I guess, almost every stop that they make. In Minnesota, not federally, but by state, you cannot take have a police interview that's not recorded. So it's all over the place. Basically, most of the time, you provide access to the material to the other side. And they have access to whatever recording devices are used, and it comes in pretty much without objection again. In terms of, it is quite unusual in criminal cases to have the electronic simulation kind of stuff that's done from time to time for illustrative purposes on the civil side. Those are usually, by the way, by way of demonstrative as opposed to substantive evidence.
And, you know, I also did want to talk a little bit about your article on the fictitious rule of evidence 808, which Judge Grimm mentioned, to expand that audience because it's an excellent article to more than eight. You want to talk about that article a little bit and what you were trying to get at?
Sure. Let me, if anybody cares, it's been referred to enough times and I don't get a nickel for anybody's accessing it. It's available on www.greenbag.org, and they have a list of articles and they have a couple of the articles and you can just pull it up. It's about 3 pages long. It's not very long. I suggest, based on the practice that I've seen, which is basically that nobody seems to object, particularly to emails, that there must be a rule, and since there must be a rule, I created it and claimed that it must have been promulgated and indicated that it was promulgated. And the rule says, if it's a corporate email, it's admissible for all purposes, and you're not allowed to object to it. Having established the rule, I kind of take a look at some things that I think people have to be really careful of. And in some ways, the article is pretty much a checklist on what you ought to do when you get an email. Who is the author? Is that author entitled to make a comment on the subject? The fact that there are, 300,000 people employed at some very large organization doesn't mean every one of them is authorized to make a declaration on behalf of the corporation. The other thing is you get strings of emails, and these become quite funny in a certain way. There can be strings of emails that go into the business and out of the business and back into the business, and you don't even know who's talking to who anymore, and all this stuff just comes in because they say, well, it's an email. That it may be a corporate record, that's an open question in some regards, but it doesn't mean that it's a declaration that's admissible against the corporation.
Judge Grimm, do you see probative value issues arising with ESI under the Federal Rules of Evidence 403? For example, social media pages, maybe it can be inflammatory, or the problem of cumulative evidence?
Well, there are two separate questions that you ask. One is whether or not social media sites create Rule 403 issues. And the other is whether Rule 403 issues can be found with respect to ESI in general. And the answer is that Rule 403, the audience is familiar with, is the rule that says if all other evidentiary hurdles have been cleared and the evidence is still admissible, it can still be excluded, despite the fact that it's relevant and it may be authentic and it may pass the hearsay test and it may meet the requirements of the original writing rule, if its probative value would be substantially outweighed by a series of harmful events, such as that it would be unfairly prejudicial, not just prejudicial, but unfairly prejudicial, or unnecessarily cumulative, or would confuse or mislead or distort. Now, a lot of stuff that appears in social media pages would be inadmissible regardless of Rule 403 on issues of relevance, or that it's improper opinion testimony, or it's hearsay, or people are talking about things of which they have no personal knowledge, so it offends Rule 602. But if you clear all those other hurdles, then to talk about excluding it under Rule 403 for prejudice, that's a hard hurdle. And I think that most judges will tell you if all you got is Rule 403, it's sort of the last thing that you say because it's better than saying, I can't think of any reason why I don't want it to come in. It's one step better than saying taint fair, judge, and it's hard to keep it out. You know, social networking sites may be highly relevant, and even though they are prejudicial in that they reveal embarrassing or personal information, if that embarrassing or personal information is relevant to the disputes and claims and the information there can be authenticated, so that, for example, if something is posted on a social website, there may be an issue about whether I actually put it on my social website or whether someone accessed it and stuck it on there, and so that it would be deemed to have been made by me and not by me myself. Those kinds of issues might crop up, but they would not be 403 issues. They'd be authentication issues. So, I mean, the key is that for something to be excluded because it is excessively prejudicial as compared to its probative value is a very hard test to beat in either a criminal or a civil case, and it must really sort of almost have a shock the conscience kind of component to it. And that's separate and discrete from some of the other evidentiary issues that may apply, in terms of cumulativeness, of course, you know, some cumulativeness allows if it's the 37th example of something that's already come in, then that might come in. And in terms of confusion of issues, that might very well be the case. But again, if it's If it's confusing, then there may be relevance objections as opposed to just simply prejudice. So I think that 403 is a measure that must be looked at, but it's a mistake to think that that somehow has greater utility than it would have, as Judge Rosenbaum said, with respect to any other kind of opinion, any other kind of evidence.
We always, frankly, you wouldn't want to put in evidence that wasn't prejudicial in your favor. And the question is unfair. It used to be unduly, but it's unfair now. And the answer is that, you know, in a murder case, the testimony and some pictures are probably admissible, but horrifying pictures sometimes can be regarded as unfairly prejudicial. But, when it comes to proving that the person's dead, you're still entitled to prove it. The question is, how shocking do you want to be?
Taking another narrow question at one of the rules with some of the media, Judge Rosenbaum, can you see texting or Facebook posts and other spontaneous communications turning into excited utterances possibly and becoming admissible? Because it is a spontaneous form of communication.
I can hear the argument, but I have a very difficult time. The way I learned the rule about spontaneous admission or spontaneous declaration, if it begins with the three words, "Oh my God," that's usually a spontaneous or excited utterance. Anything much short of that, you might have present recollection recorded. You might have some other form of recordation, but by the time you sit around and keystroke a message, or you thumb it into your BlackBerry, it becomes much more difficult in my mind for it to be an excited utterance. As I said, those are usually preceded by "Oh my God," that usually indicates an excited utterance.
Go ahead.
I think those are very helpful. Comments on there. I think that some of the medium that's out there, though, tweets or text messages, which can almost be very spontaneous.
Still 140 keystrokes.
Yeah, if you have a present sense impression under Rule 803.1, it has to be a statement that explains or it's a statement made while perceiving an event or immediately thereafter that explains or describes it. So if you're watching something that has some ongoing nature, so for example, there's an earthquake and the earthquake lasts 7 seconds and you are in the middle of text messaging somebody while it's going on, you can make an argument that you could qualify it as a present sense impression. If it's an excited utterance under Rule 803.2, then you have longer temporal spacing allowed to it because it's while you are under the stimulus of the event that caused the excitement. So if you watch something that caused, like an earthquake or a tidal wave, you might be worked up for several minutes and you could send an email or a text message or a tweet that would describe that.
By the way, at a tech show last week, somebody said they saw an article and you can get to a point where I think it probably does qualify. Supposedly, somebody broke into a house and a child hid in a closet but had a BlackBerry with them and sent a 911 message, a message to the police, and text more or less the following. Somebody's hitting my daddy. It sounds like our neighbor. Is that's a present sense impression, but also it's awfully close to an excited utterance. So it was used as part of an identification for who the attacker was.
I think that's amazing. It doesn't surprise me. Judge Rosenbaum, I'm waiting for my favorite, which I'm sure it's happened, and if it's out there, I'd love to hear about it because I talk about it as sort of the unicorn mythical beast in my evidence class. I'm waiting for the digital dying declaration.
Oh, yes.
Person's lying there in a pool of blood and takes out their cell phone and text messages, Johnny did it, and then dies.
It's going to happen. We're all addicted to these tools.
Voice recognition, with you get the Dragon software in your computer, you could do it exactly that way just by gasping, why did Johnny kill me? Bang, down you go.
Oh man, I can see all the authentication and issues and looking at the code with what is trained software.
Be careful, Johnny's a very dangerous person.
Yep. Judge Grimm, how do privacy concerns play into electronically stored information? I mean, what shouldn't be discoverable?
Okay, now let's make sure that we're paying attention to the transition in your question, because we're talking discovery as opposed to admissibility. And privacy concerns, with the exception of how they might possibly fit into Rule 403, are largely not going to play a great deal in admissibility issues, because you'll deal with relevance, and if there's privacy concern, it may have some minor issue as to deal with prejudice, but otherwise it's not going to have a whole lot to do with the decision of admissibility. Discoverability, privacy concerns also are not a driving force. I mean, the scope of discovery is pretty clearly set out in Rule 26b-1, and if you look at it, it's matters that are relevant to the claims or defenses that have been pleaded, and that's a narrower scope that was inaugurated in December 2000 when they narrowed the definition in the Rules of Civil Procedure. It can't be privileged or work product protected. That's covered by Rule 26b-5 and 26b-3 for work product protection. It also, if it's not discoverable, if it's under Rule 26b-2b, if it's from a source that's not reasonably accessible because of undue burden or cost. And once you've gotten through those thresholds, it's not discoverable if under Rule 26b-2c, if you apply the cost-benefit balancing factors and it is excessively expensive given its evidentiary value. Once you've gotten through those screening factors, privacy is irrelevant to the issue of whether it is discoverable. Where privacy is relevant is whether or not you should issue a protective order under Rule 26C, and protective orders do not deal with whether it's discoverable, but whether or not there should be some measures put in place to address issues that very clearly can consider embarrassment or humiliation, or oppressiveness or burden or those types of things that would be very relevant to an issue of privacy. So if someone posts on their Facebook a very explicit and description of an intimate aspect of their life, and if it were publicly displayed, it could cause embarrassment or humiliation, but were nonetheless relevant, then the issue in discovery would not be whether it is discoverable, because if it's relevant and not privileged, then it's going to be discoverable. The issue would be, do we protect somehow the manner in which it is produced and the manner in which it can be used and the persons to whom it may be shown in a way that will take into consideration concerns about privacy. But keep in mind, once you get past discovery, if it's relevant and otherwise admissible, then the fact that it may embarrass the dickens out of somebody or reveal very private information is not going to matter on the admissibility issue.
And in this world of Tiger Woods, et cetera, I think embarrassment thresholds have been so pushed out.
Well, cell phone messages, both to him and the recipients, the fact that it might be embarrassing does not affect admissibility. It may not be admissible for lots of other reasons, but the fact that it's intimate material is not going to decide the question.
And you hear about these kids doing what's that new coin, that new phrase, sexting. They take pictures of their private parts and email them to somebody. That's got to be embarrassing as heck. It doesn't mean it's not admissible, and it doesn't mean it's not discoverable if it's otherwise relevant.
Judge Rosenbaum, you wrote another interesting article where you had concerns with admitting, quote, deleted electronically stored information. Let's not include cases where spoliation has occurred, just documents which were deleted in the normal case of deciding an author just doesn't want to save the information. What are your thoughts on the admissibility of that?
That was the first article, which you can also find if anybody cares. It's called In Defense of the Delete Key. And maybe it was just an old man's being plaintive about the fact that in the old days when I had paper, if I said something stupid, I could just take the paper and wad it up and throw it in a thing, that, a device for younger listeners. It was called a waste basket. I'll explain that for them if they need it. But you put it in a waste basket and somebody took it away and they burned it and nobody ever had to be concerned about it. And with a computer, you can't do that. And, you know, the word delete, anybody who's listening to this probably knows, you push the delete key, nothing gets deleted. It just gets taken off of a certain form of listing that makes it accessible, but it never goes away. Interestingly, the Supreme Court is wandering around a question somewhat similar, because almost everybody's computers, or many, many people's computers, are owned by their employers. They're supplied by their employers. So are their cell phones in many cases, Blackberries, all the other communication devices. And it also deals with the question of who has access to that information. I use my computer for my work purposes doesn't mean if I also happen to be writing a novel that my employer is entitled to get the text of the novel. But that's kind of an open question, and the Supreme Court's got a kind of a version of that question right now. I think it's a police officer who had a computer of some sort, but was allowed, or a telephone of some sort, he was allowed to use it for personal purposes for some occasions. So you get some of those kinds of questions. You also have to sort of double back. The Supreme Court a couple of years ago, in the Arthur Anderson case, wrote a section in the opinion supporting the use of document destruction programs, not ones designed to eliminate evidence that is otherwise admissible, or not one that's set up sort of ex post, but a document destruction program, they said, is perfectly authentic and perfectly acceptable. It's a sound business practice. Well, we kind of have to figure out where these pieces all fit together, because a document destruction program, there are awfully good forensic people who can figure out what it was that was destroyed. Now, the Supreme Court said it's an okay and sound practice to do it. What happens if somebody can recover it? And those questions are really not resolved yet.
This is very important, what Judge Rosenbaum has said. And it puts it necessarily gets us into the notion of deletion versus spoliation. There have been two recent decisions, the Rimkus case out of the Southern District of Texas that Judge Rosenthal authored recently, and the Pension Committee case out of the Southern District where Judge Shinlin recently authored it, that have gotten a lot of discussion about the duty to preserve and how it must be maintained and the consequences for failing to do so. But this has trickled into concerns about the costs and burdens associated with maintaining infinite amounts of ESI when the volume is enormous and the storage capacity can be great, but which then just creates information that stays around longer than it would be back in the paper days when stuff that you were done with you would just routinely throw away. Just because you deleted something doesn't mean there was spoliation. Just because stuff wasn't saved doesn't mean it has any, that there was any obligation to save it. And the problem has become that the notion of the duty to preserve evidence has sort of been elevated to, because it comes from the common law and is a duty owed to the court, not to another adversary. And because it's not governed directly by the rules, since it can trigger, and often does, before litigation has been filed, it has become sort of the tail wagging the dog in terms of what it has done, and has led to a certain amount of paralysis. I mean, Judge Rosenbaum's point is also illustrated by the change in December 2010, the Rule 37E, which says that the loss or destruction of electronically stored information will not be a grounds for sanctioning under the rules of procedure, civil procedure, if it was lost as a matter of the routine and good faith operation of an electronic records management system.
And that really ties in electronic material when you turn on your computer or you turn it off, a whole bunch of files gets destroyed or created, and you had nothing to do with that. In that regard, you have modified your data, but you didn't do it with any intention other than to turn on and turn off your computer most of the time. It's worthwhile, if you get into these kinds of issues, to talk to somebody who's pretty sharp on the forensics. Now, this is one of the things, by the way, that I would suggest when it comes to dealing, when you ask what are the problems that ESI are providing, the lawyers have gotten good at seeking the information, but they're not always quite as facile at knowing what it means that they're getting and what the upshot is that it's accessible. There are areas where lawyers need to keep themselves up on the curve about the area, the information that's available, and how it can be accessed. There's also an interesting little debate in the two cases that Judge Grimm just referred to. Judge Shindlin, amidst many interesting things that she said in her opinion, said these questions will be reviewed through the view of 2020 hindsight. And Judge Rosenthal, who may have stumbled onto it, but I don't think she did by accident, said through the distortions of 2020 hindsight. And so there's going to be some of these elements in the cases.
And I think that this is a great challenge as we go forward, is trying to remember that in the discovery world, that proportionality is applicable to all discovery. If Judge Rosenthal and I, or Judge Rosenbaum, or Judge Shindlin and I, or anyone else, is involved in a dispute, and we have to decide it, we all recognize that it doesn't make any sense to spend $1 million to resolve a $10,000 dispute. And the notion of the evidentiary implications of not preserving evidence, deletion or spoliation, the duty to preserve, which is a non-rule-based evidentiary obligation created within the common law, has to fit into the same rational scheme that governs the litigation once a suit's been filed. It makes no sense to impose a more onerous obligation pre-litigation than would be imposed post-litigation. And all discovery has to be filtered through the proportionality. And so what people do in terms of saving information that may be within the scope of the duty to preserve, the notion of doing that which is reasonably proportional to the dispute that might involve that evidence has got to fit somewhere into the equation. It hasn't been worked out yet. Judge Rosenbaum is absolutely right to say that this is something that has to be worked out, because it is, many lawyers feel, the greatest cost-driving factor, and the gotcha aspect of trying to figure out what you do if something hasn't been preserved, which requires you to show a duty to preserve and a failure to preserve, some level of culpability, and then relevance and prejudice when you can't. How do you measure relevance and prejudice when the evidence that was to be evaluated is no longer there? Creates enormous problems and distractions, puts enormous burdens on courts and costs on litigants. And the one thing that's got to come out of this debate at some point, whether it's sooner rather than later, as Judge Rosenbaum says, is some sort of consensus about what the contours are that govern the scope of the duty to preserve, which is an evidentiary obligation of common law, not of rule.
Let me see if I can offer a couple other thoughts on that, because it's a large concern. The duty to preserve, as we're talking about it, seems to devolve onto the parties who are involved when there's a reasonable likelihood of litigation. Well, in 21st century America, there's a reasonable likelihood that somebody's going to get sued about something almost all the time. Now, that's the absurd point of it. You reach to that point and you say, well, you have to preserve everything all the time. Now let me look back 933,000 years ago when I was a young lawyer. If you had a real estate transaction or a commercial transaction, you would do your work, you would finish the transaction, and then you would take the file and go through and keep the things that you needed to keep, throw away most of your notes, throw away the first drafts of the contract because it wasn't worth your time to save them, and you had to pay rent on the room to have the storage, and you threw stuff away. You did it all the time. A file that had been 2-3 inches thick would be a quarter inch thick a year after the case was over. It just was no sense in saving it. Well, now we've eliminated the cost of floor space for saving things because the computer keeps it. But if there are deletions that are made, or if there is a document destruction plan in effect that clears out your emails after 30 days, that's different than spoliation, different than depriving investigators of information. It's just a system that's set up. The other part of it, of course, is you cannot delete things. If there is an obligation to preserve it, either imposed by law or when you know that Ms. Jones claimed that Mr. Johnson sexually harassed her, and you get a letter from an opponent on the other side, or a potential opponent says, we're contemplating a lawsuit against you, at that point, you would be very ill-advised to let an automatically operating deletion system delete Mr. Johnson's regular emails. At that point, you obviously have a different set of obligations. But where one kicks in and where one lets off has not really been refined just yet.
There's one other element I would add into there, and it ties into proportionality. In the real world of going out and gathering evidence, there has been a decided trend towards self-collecting and not deploying forensics people because that sounds expensive. Go get the evidence, and I think that could tie right back into this admissibility quagmire. Where did you get it?
Judge Shindlin was wandering around the subject that you were just describing, too. I think it's insufficient to just send an email blast throughout a company and say, don't get rid of anything. You better have somebody who knows how to keep you from doing that, sort of superintending the system. Somebody, if there is a document preservation system going on, you can't just do it in general. You need somebody with enough competence so that you're entitled, so that you realistically will preserve the relevant material.
So for the future litigants that maybe get into this issue, that might be one area they want to explore. Anyway, this has been really an excellent discussion, and we could probably go on for another hour, but to keep these things digestible, I think if you guys have any, if you Judge Rosenbaum and Judge Graham, if you have anything else you want to add, predictions for future battles, this might be a good time to add that in on admissibility VSI.
I guess all I can tell you is, like everything else, the law looks at situations that have developed and looks back at them. I'm sure that things are happening right now that will be of enormous interest to me and Judge Grimm in the future. It's just that the world is producing more interesting ones than we can think of right now.
Well, and the other thing, too, is this problem is not going to go away because, technology continues to move quickly and will always outpace us. 5 years ago, when I think it was about the time I first had the privilege of being on a panel and working with Judge Rosenbaum, there were no such things as twits and tweets and Twitters and the twits that send them. That didn't exist. There was no iPad, and next year there'll be something that didn't exist today. And the reassuring thing is that the analytical framework on the evidentiary implications of these will not change. It is in the rules of evidence. There's some minor tweaks that will come out in the rules of evidence probably in the next year or so that make clear that some of the record-based rules refer to digital information as well, which is a definitional issue, not a substantive issue. But the reassuring thing is the basic framework is the same as it was, as Judge Rosenbaum said, 50 years ago when you were dealing with written documents and photographs that were developed from film, not from bits and bytes.
Well, thank you both, Judge Groom and Judge Rosenbaum, for joining us as guests again on ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have both of you on the show. We also look forward to next week when I am having Judge Groom join me again to co-host the show with me, interviewing 8 law students who are taking classes at 3 different law schools on electronic discovery. It should be an interesting show. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a list of our shows. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as it's Easy Bytes of ESI information, just how ESI Bytes sounds when you pronounce it. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bytes you back. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Thank you.